doing some reading, I came across a statement from a French leader who commented after France fell to the Nazis. Said, we wanted to have more than we wanted to give. We spared effort and met disaster, which I think is apropos of a great many things, I think including this general arena of politics and government. I want to talk about finances and the field of politics and government today. Just as background, for those of you who haven't been here previously, I would just remind you that on the two previous lectures, I pointed out that domestic poverty is of much greater depth than the huge majority of Americans have any comprehension of, and somehow we have to get across to these people that the kind of a problem that confronts us. If we're willing to confront the problem, I think we're willing to face some realistic answers. The second is the fact that government tends to respond to pressures rather than needs. As a part of this, I suggested the need not to set up for yourself any grandiose plans about saving the world, but be willing to do some little specific things. I finished reading a couple of weeks ago, and Gene is reading now the book that's published a month ago or so now on borrowed time. It's a story of the start of World War II. And it's an amazing thing how there was no, you know, we imagine that when Hitler marched into Czechoslovakia, or, you know, one dramatic incident started World War II. But what really happened was 1,000 little things went wrong. 1,000 people didn't do what they should have done. And all of these things built into the creation of the kind of an atmosphere where you can have a World War II. But I mentioned in this whole area of pressures versus needs, the field of finances, that you feel an obligation to those who help elect you to office. And this is an area that we haven't really honestly faced up to. Let me give you a few practical examples. The first time I was running against the party organization, my party organization, and I wasn't supposed to have a chance. And I found I received virtually no contributions. The second time, when I was running for re-elections, all of a sudden these campaign contributions were there. It was a very strange thing. One group, and one of the pledges I made at that point was that I was going to give some kind of a synopsis of my campaign contributions and expenditures, as well as a detailed publication of my personal income. Well, one of the groups that came to me said that with a $300 campaign contribution and offered it to me, and I hesitated and told them I wanted to think it over. And I checked the record, and on 28 bills that they were interested in, I found I voted against them on 26 times. Now, the executive director of this particular association came to me and said they like young men in politics, and they wanted to give me this $300 campaign contribution. And he said, as is always said, you know, no strings attached. The problem is, are there no strings attached? If I would have accepted that $300, the next time the same issues come up, then I was in the House of Representatives, same issues come up. Will I be able to stand up? Maybe I'd vote exactly the same, but maybe I would think, well, after all, these fellows can't be too bad. They contributed a sizable amount to my campaign. Maybe I'll just be quiet. Any group that contributes $300 to my campaign obviously has to have great nobility and, you know, great good judgment and so forth. I'm just suggesting that even, you know, there is no such thing as a campaign contribution, no strings attached. You feel a sense of obligation to the people who contribute to a campaign. And I think this is one of the realities. A second reality is the cost of campaigns. A campaign for governor of Illinois, for example, you have to figure a minimum cost of about $2 million. In my office like mine, that's a kind of a peripheral office. My race for lieutenant governor, and this is probably the smallest expenditure of any candidate for statewide office in Illinois this last time, but my campaign cost $108,000 for lieutenant governor. My opponent spent many times that amount. I don't know how much exactly, but had spent more than 2.5 times that amount in simply securing the agency. He had Whitaker and Baxter from California managing his campaign. Well, this presents some problems. It presents some very practical problems. If you're a candidate, you don't have equal financing. It was frankly a frustrating thing to go along the expressways in Chicago and see these big billboards that he had that I couldn't afford. You know, this is the kind of thing. This is part of the reality. The costs of campaigning have just gotten out of hand. Who pays for the cost of the campaign? Well, you pay, the taxpayer, the person who doesn't contribute to any campaign, pays and pays very, very hard. Who contributes to a campaign directly? I would say 98% of those who contribute are people who have some kind of an economic axe to grind. Now, usually, particularly if you have some kind of a record, there are people who generally sympathize with your point of view. But whether it's a business interest or labor unions or what it is, there are people who have some economic motivation, who in fact think they're not donating money but investing money. And the long experience is that they get a return on that investment. This is the reality. Now, they get a return on that investment, and who loses in the process? I think the average citizen is ultimately the loser. Someone who's in the highway construction business who donates $5,000 to a race for governor, is he doing this out of the goodness of his heart? I think it's very, very doubtful that he just suddenly sees great virtue in some one candidate. And I think the best illustration of this, that most people in this situation donate, usually isn't the same amount, but donate to both sides. You'll find this at the national level where there are requirements for disclosure of campaign contributions. You look at two candidates who ran against each other, you will frequently find the same person donating to both candidates, sometimes the same amount to both candidates. And the reason is they want to have a little leverage when that campaign is over. It means that the most honorable public official feels some very real obligations. I haven't promised a soul I'm going to do anything as lieutenant governor, or when I was running for the state senator for the state House of Representatives. And yet you do feel, if someone calls or comes to my office who has made a campaign contribution, and I can't see everybody during the course of the day who wants to come and talk to me. You have to be somewhat selective. I can't take every phone call that comes in. Who do you talk to? Well, among others, I will talk to those who contribute to my campaign. I'd be an ingrate if I didn't. But it also means that those who have the economic resources have special access to people who make decisions. I think this is one of the realities. Then a second means of financing is that a candidate sometimes is through the party organization. But here again, where do they get the money? And if they get the money from Tom Smith, and I don't mean to, well, let's forget the contractors for a minute, but Tom Smith, who sells envelopes to the state. And you just take a little item like that, you're talking about millions of dollars. Tom Smith sells envelopes to the state, so he makes a donation to the state Republican or Democratic Party. And if you're a candidate and you accept X amount of dollars from your state organization or the county organization or whatever it is, and then they come to you after the election and say, can you give whoever it is, do a little favor, throw a little bit of state business in his direction. It's pretty hard to say no. So that the whole system, I think, in fact, somewhat compromises the public official. And more important, again, getting back to this problem of people with great needs, makes him tend to be responsive to the powerful economic interests rather than the people who really have great need. The fellow who lives in Polk County that I mentioned, where there's great economic deprivation, doesn't get a lot of power through the system of campaign contributions that exist. A second major problem in the whole field is the inequities. I touched on it in my own race. I was reading the biography of Warren G. Harding, The Shadow of Blooming Grove, and just in the footnote, I noticed that Warren Harding spent about six times as much as Cox did in the 1920 race. Cox believed in the League of Nations. Harding campaigned against it. What if the two could have spent the same amount of money? Would Cox have won, maybe? Would we have had a League of Nations, a viable League of Nations? Would we have had World War II? Is this, again, one of the little things that that happened wrong, one of the little things that helped build for a wrong situation? In New York, in the state of New York, the last gubernatorial race, Governor Rockefeller, and I happen to be an admirer of Governor Rockefeller. I think, by and large, he's done a tremendous job in the state of New York. But Rockefeller spent $7 million in his race, a little more than $7 million. His opponent, New York has disclosure requirements, his opponent spent a little more than $536,000. Now, I think probably if they could have spent the same amount of money, Rockefeller would have won anyway. But I think the political realities are that if the two were even, as far as being known quantities to the public, anyone who spends $7 million over against the fellow who spends $536,000, it's very obvious the fellow who spends $7 million is going to win. in the one assembly race in New York, a man who was a total unknown beat the incumbent, who had an excellent record apparently, but the man who was a total unknown spent $251,000 to get elected to the State House of Representatives in New York. And, you know, I don't know, there aren't too many people who can defeat a candidate for the legislature who's willing to spend $251,000. But is this right? I think the answer is it's not right. I think we have to do something about it. There's a second area that's related to this whole area of finances, and that is the confidence of the public in what officials are doing. Are public officials in reality serving the public interest or their own private economic interest? I think the Fortas case, the Abe Fortas case, is a very graphic illustration of the kind of thing that really gets the public disturbed about people who hold public office. We have in Illinois right now a case where a man who was under indictment just prior to a ruling of the state Supreme Court gave two justices of the Supreme Court some bank stock as a gift. I don't know what's going to happen. I'm not, obviously, a case that probably is going to come into court is a case I wouldn't want to comment on as far as the guilt or innocence of the parties involved. But it certainly raises substantial questions. And is the kind of thing I think ought to be involved, ought to be faced up to, honestly. What are the answers for this kind of a thing? Teddy Roosevelt suggested a long time ago and got nowhere with it that government ought to pay for campaign finance, that there should be no such thing as a private contribution. And while this immediately repels a great many people because they think, why should my tax dollars go to pay for campaign financing? The fact is, they're paying for campaign financing right now in the worst possible way. It would mean that the public official is obligated not to some special private interest, but to the populace as a whole. And the populace as a whole is the group to whom he should feel an obligation. There was a proposal in the U.S. Senate 2 years ago that in congressional campaigns they would experiment on this. I'd like to see an experiment where people would have the option. They had so much per vote available for campaign financing. Their suggestion, for example, was in a Senate race in Illinois, you would have the formula worked out to about $1 million in a Senate race in Illinois from federal funds.
National Senate.
National Senate, the U.S. Senate. Now, this would be somewhat lower than a candidate would ordinarily spend on a Senate race in Illinois. But I would think that the candidate who did this would have a real political tool to go out and say, I'm not taking any special interest money, I just want to serve the people. So that I think that such a program that offers options might be a successful program. Again, you run into the problem of inequities. But sometimes the British, of course, have a system where, it's difficult to make analogies of one system to another, but they prohibit any kind of private contribution. And I have a strong feeling this has to be part of the future. In the meantime, candidates, I think, have to depend on average citizens who are willing to send in $10 or, you know, small amounts. Of the, it's interesting, in our campaign, in my own campaign for Lieutenant Governor, of the $108,000 that was spent, about $27,000 came in contributions of $25 or less. That's an unusually high percentage. And I personally think was a healthy thing. One of the other things that I have felt kind of immunizes a candidate a little bit from some of the pressures are, is the campaign, the $50 plate dinner, where you, frankly, you don't know who all is buying tickets. You see a lot of people there, and you're very grateful to them. You raise a substantial amount of money. We raised in two dinners about $50,000. And you don't feel any, you don't feel the same kind of an obligation as if someone comes up and hands a check to you. In a sense, they're getting a little entertainment and food for their money. And you feel like they're getting a little, in part, their money's worth. Part of the answer for the problem of a public official and where he gets his personal income, I think, has to be some kind of disclosure law. A disclosure law that covers, first of all, lobbyists, much stronger than anything we have now in any state or in the federal government. I am not knocking lobbyists. I think they perform a very useful function. They're experts in the field. If a bill comes up in, let's say, regarding railroads, you can contact the railroad lobby, the Railroad Brotherhood lobby, the trucking lobby, and a few others, and in a very short time, get some expert opinion from a variety of perspectives on particular legislation. The difficulty is that too often the general public is not represented in this process. And too often, even though it's by a small minority of lobbyists, in fact, money buys legislation. And I don't mean just through bribery, but through the the dinner, the cocktail party, the all the other things that go with effective lobbying. Disclosure also ought to include, in my opinion, the public official himself. If there had been disclosure by members of the U.S. Supreme Court, I doubt that Abe Fortas would ever have accepted the money that he accepted and gotten himself into this kind of a compromising position. My personal situation, I've done this now for 14 years, disclosed in detail. I think one of my one stock in which I have, and I don't have too many stocks, but I think one of was a total dividend of about 18 cents, and the 18 cents went on the on my disclosure statement. If I speak to a Rotary Club and they give me $10, the $10 goes on the disclosure statement. Every penny that I get and my wife get goes on this disclosure statement. Doesn't hurt me at all. And I think does some good for the public in the sense that they feel a public official is not trying to fill his own pocket. One of the things I've done now, and as Lieutenant Governor, before I hired any of my staff, and I have, when I say staff, it's very small, I have 5 administrative assistants and 4 secretaries. Every administrative assistant, before he was hired, knew that he had to, starting next year, because it'll be the first complete calendar year that I will have held office as Lieutenant Governor, he and his wife will have to issue a joint public statement. We're going to do it all together. Not that this is going to guarantee anyone's honesty, but I think it's goes a pretty long ways to assuring the public that those who serve are not filling their pockets. They may differ with what we do, but I don't think they'll question our motivation if that's the situation. Well, that very briefly is an area where I think we've got to face up to some realities. And I thought at this point I'd cut the discussion short since I took more of my time than I intended away from discussion in the previous session. We can get into financing, but I also thought I'd leave it free for anything else you want to toss out. And please feel free to be frank, and I'll be feel free to be equally frank in my responses. Yes?
This is a matter of campaign expenses from the government. Sounds great, but I wanted to know what the kind of accommodation could be made for third party, fourth party, seventh party, 20th party candidates if there becomes a fund available. What limitation can there be in that sort of problem?
I think the limitation has to be that that expenditures by candidates do not receive the same problem.
Really, that they actually represent. They're going to create an image in order to get an office. And I wondered if there is no down-to-earth and more grassroots politics, real philosophy, and with efforts to change the system. Now, you mentioned so many things here that are just outstanding, but I noticed that you always talk in the future. We'll do this, we'll do that, and so on. This is political philosophy. Now, that should be put together, and there's a political party that will stand for it. And then the other thing will be the record that will come and say, this political party did this, and this, and this, and then you'll have kind of a credit and liability, or also an asset ledger in which the political party will be credited for what it does. Now it seems all sort of kind of a pot shot, you know, you scatter the gun and you do this and that, and you never know really what stands and who stands for whom. And it's very hard to be really involved in politics.
Well, you're covering a number of areas. It's true, we don't have the kind of delineation of party positions in the United States that you do in the European systems. I personally prefer this lack of clear-cut party delineation, so that if I'm a member of the Senate and I want to differ with my party on whether or not there should be a sales tax increase, this doesn't mean the government's going to fall. It doesn't mean that I'm not going to be automatically re-slated as a candidate of my party and so forth. Although I confess there are pros and cons in all of this. I think the other thing is, for example, right now, neither political party is willing to take the kind of positions that I've suggested here right now on financing, for the very reason that they don't want to cut off the financing that they now have. Now, I hope the time will come when there are going to be enough people who are going to be aware of the problem so that we can move, and one political party or the other will. I think the political party structure, however, is strong enough, much stronger than you suggest, so that neither party ordinarily is going to just put up someone who's going to be, who has no political philosophy, who's simply going to be campaigning so that, when we talk about the $1 million, you're talking about money that's very carefully audited. So no one's going to be putting half of that in his pocket, as you suggest. But I think that the two political parties in Illinois or California or Oregon or Maryland or wherever it is are generally going to try, because they want to win. They're going to put up candidates that are strong candidates. Now, you do occasionally under the present system, and I suppose always will, run into cases where you have two relatively weak candidates. But I think the parties are strong enough, and there is, even today, I think while there are exceptions and while there are parties within parties, and this is really how we work the multi-party system in the United States, is the multi-party works within the two parties, even though we do have occasionally a Henry Wallace or a George Wallace or, you know, some third or fourth party that tries to move on the scene, but never very successfully. 1912 has been the last time, really, since 1860. That a third party has made any kind of a really substantial move on the national scene. But the answer to the confusion, I think, is involvement. I think once you get a little bit involved and get to know the personalities and get to know the people and what they stand for, or even the little thing like the coffee hour. If you attend two coffee hours, candidates for Congress from the two political parties, I think you're going to have a pretty fair idea of their philosophy, where what they stand for, what direction they're going. Now, you do find occasions where the candidates are not, you know, not too far apart. But generally, I think you'll find a pretty much of a cleavage on some issues anyway.
Paul, did you say in the matter of governmental financing of campaigns that this would be restricted in effect to the final election, not part of the primary?
No, I think you have to involve the primary, but I think there has to be some restriction, both in the way of a filing fee and in the way of percentage of the votes received before you get the any primary assistance.
Could you give an example, for instance? Take your rate of running as in the assembly, how would you have suggested this system could work there?
Well, I think, for example, if running for the assembly, if you had a filing fee of $100 even, I think you would eliminate the candidate who just wants to put his name on the ballot for no reason at all, and then say you have to get at least 25% of the vote before you're going to get refinanced on your campaign expenditures. You have to keep a very careful record of what is spent.
But you then have to get contributions to use for that expense initially.
Presumably you could get a substantial candidate could get loans for this kind of a, you know, for that kind of a race for the assembly. Here you're talking about a race where the expenditures would not be, you know, more than $5,000, $10,000 ordinarily.
Would the risk of the loans fall on the individual that's running or the party?
I would think they'd fall on the, here you're talking on a primary.
Yeah.
By background, I might mention that the reason why I think the primary is so important is that in Mississippi, the primary is the election. In Vermont this last time, they didn't even put up a Democratic candidate for United States Senator. Mississippi, at least there's usually a Republican candidate who's a nominee. So that the primary frequently is the election, depending on the state or the district. So I think that if you use the system and ignore the primaries, in effect, while it would be a step forward, it would be ignoring a very vital part of the process.
You can get a dozen candidates in a primary, for example. I've seen
right.
this.
I think that what this would do would be to diminish the number of candidates who would run in the primary.
I'll tell you, the crackpots in California are willing to pay more than $100 to put their name on the ballot.
The problem in California is you have rich crackpots.
How much do you think that your disclosure of your campaign contributions helps you? I mean, do you think this is a big item? The average person wants an honest guy, doesn't it?
The average person wants an honest guy, and I don't think there's any question, but it's a political plus. And I think particularly, now in my case, for Lieutenant Governor, I was running against a gentleman who was a fine fellow, but who happened to personally be a millionaire. who had Whitaker and Chambers from California. And I can't help but think that the contrast helped me somewhat.
But you have to get it out to the public.
You've got to get it out.
It's newest to the people.
Right. Yes.
What guarantees are there that a dishonest politician wouldn't make a dishonest statement?
Well, I think the two, I don't think there are anything to completely guarantee this. I think the two things you have is, number one, you have to have very careful auditing of the expenditures. And I think this is a pretty much a guarantee. And then I think the second thing is removal from office. And that's a pretty powerful guarantee. And it's interesting that the state of Oregon has a disclosure requirement. And I believe three, anyone here from Oregon? Either two or three members of the Oregon Assembly were removed from office within the past years because they did not fully disclose. My guess is that candidates in the future in the state of Oregon will be pretty careful about disclosure. Yeah. Yes.
What about the subject of conflict of interest in politics? You know, where a man, well, the case of the the Assistant Secretary of Defense Packard, I guess it was, and the fact that he had to sell stock or at least put his stock in limbo or whatever to the old office. What about this whole matter of conflict of interest?
Well, this is another, this is a big area, and it's interesting that the conflict event, for example, Wright Patman's committee in the House from your state, Vern, insisted that Dave Kennedy, the Secretary of Treasury, get rid of all of his stock in the bank in Chicago. And I think they were perfectly proper in doing this. But it's interesting that the members of the committee that insisted that he get rid of this stock had all kinds of conflicts of interest themselves. I think the disclosure has to be part of the procedure. If the public knows exactly where you stand, for most of the time I was in the Illinois General Assembly, I own some newspapers. And, you know, this was public knowledge. In fact, they even knew how much I was making on each newspaper. Right now, anyone who wants it can find out exactly how many shares of what stock I own. And I think so long as they know this, this is about the best protection you can have. Now, I think there are inevitably conflicts of interest in the sense that a farmer is going to be a member of the General Assembly or of Congress, and farm legislation is going to come up. Senator Eastland of Mississippi is perhaps a prime example here. His farm gets $120,000 or so subsidy each year. But I don't suggest Senator Eastland or anyone else who has a farm shouldn't vote on farm legislation. I don't happen to favor the $120,000 subsidy.
But should he have to sell out all of his holdings in order to hold the government office?
I don't think he should. No. My feeling is the disclosure ought to be the answer. And then if there is something that violates the public sense. In other words, if I were running against Eastland in Mississippi, I'd sure use that $120,000 that he's getting from the government against him, because I think it's a pretty powerful political weapon. And I don't think you can expect people who are in Congress to divest themselves, or people who are in executive or positions generally, to divest themselves totally of any holdings. But I think we're entitled to know what those holdings are so that we see the potential.